KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, presenting an evening with author, journalist, and social observer Fran Lebowitz, Thursday, January 23rd, downtown at the historic Balboa Theater. Tickets and upcoming performances at artpower.ucsd.edu.
It's time for Midday Edition on KPBS. For today's show, we're talking about the year-long flood recovery effort happening in San Diego's Black Arts and Culture District. Then, your weekend preview highlights upcoming film festivals. I'm Jade Hindman, with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and engaged. How business owners and artists were impacted by the devastating floods 1 year ago.
Everyone's business was closed and, you know, inundated with mud and just, you know, something that you've been building all your life.
The efforts to rebuild, plus a preview of the Black Film Festival and Jewish Film Festival. That's ahead on Midday Edition. It has been a year since floodwaters inundated neighborhoods like Encanto, the birthplace of San Diego's Black Arts and Culture District, which is a real gem in the city. Many artists and businesses there are still recovering from the damage left behind, so we're checking in to see how they're doing and how they're continuing to move forward 1 year later. Dahan Blevins is the founder and CEO of the nonprofit arts organization San Diego Urban Warriors. Dahan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is LaRaza Webb. She co-founded the Block Club, an incoming community space in the district. LaRaza, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So I'm really glad to have you both on. Dahan, I'll start with you. Last time we had you on the show, you talked about some of the businesses that were affected. Remind us of the damage you saw then and how groups like your own were impacted.
Exactly. In southeastern San Diego, where we have the what we call Land of Enchanted, the nine blocks of Black Arts Culture District, we had really got geared up, you know, excited about getting the designation and had a whole year of planning. We even brought back the Mr. Black San Diego competition, and then the flood happened. So the boys, what used to be the Boys and Girls Club, is now the Synergy Building, and there's over 13 Black-owned businesses in that building, and all of them were flooded out, from daycare to music schools to coding schools to programs that, you know, are specialized in helping young African-American boys go to college, all the way down to 61st Street, where the Black Contractors Association was. There was maybe four businesses, I think something at Trolley Stop, where the land was a little higher, that were the only four businesses that weren't affected, all the way from 69th all the way down to 61st. Everyone's business was closed and, you know, inundated with mud and just, you know, you're something that you've been building all your life. Mm-hmm. Somebody says a 100-year flood comes and you lose all of it. We still aren't in our building that we were in, our office space.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm listening to you talk, and it's one thing to lose, you know, the brick and mortar buildings, but the community that is lost when something like that happens. Talk to me a bit about that.
Wow. Everything was so long. It took such a long time to get here. You know what I'm saying? We literally have been fighting this fight for over 37 years. And then to get that close and something that's, you know, a natural disaster, it really affected a lot of people, especially the people who've been in this battle for such a long time, who live in the 4th District in southeastern San Diego. Some people begin to, I think we're just cursed. You know, many people are saying that's why people are moving away. That's why so many young people say, I'm trying to get out of the hood. This is not a hood. This is a neighborhood. And the core of us didn't allow the flood to make us think we're just going to give up. And we just continue. We still continue to strive and lo and behold, things are looking really good.
Well, LaRaza, I want to bring you into the conversation here because you're an active member in the community. How were you impacted by last year's floods?
Our building is located on 64th and Imperial, so we were also submerged. There were art supplies and other inventory completely destroyed. The fear of mold growing in the walls literally like haunted us in our sleep. We would, when we spoke with insurance companies, they totally backed out and didn't pay for anything. It was a true tragedy for us. And it wasn't just about the physical damage. It was a disruption, as you're saying, to the vital work that we do, you know, in serving our community. We had to push our timeline back. But what really stood out, I would say, during that challenging time was the resilience of our team and the incredible support that we received from the community. You know, people showed up to help us clean, remove damaged furniture, donating supplies, just to kind of help us, you know, keep our vision alive. And it reminded us of, you know, why we do this work, because our community is strong, are creative, and we're deeply connected to one another.
And I want to talk about the community space you're building, the Block Club. I mean, what's its main mission?
Yeah. So a year later, I'm thrilled to share that we're not just rebuilding, but growing. This March, we're planning to open the Block Club as a dynamic member-based hub for creativity, culture, and community. We'll host educational programs, art workshops, performances, and community conversations, etc. It'll truly be a multifunctional environment. Our mission, we believe that by gathering people together from all over to embrace Black arts and culture, we can defy assumptions about who we are and strengthen our community. It's all a part of our commitment to providing a space where people can feel inspired, supported, and empowered.
And why do you think it's important to really have a space like this where everyone can gather, especially as the community continues to recover?
I just think that it's really important that we stamp this impact so that people of all ages and backgrounds feel empowered to create and connect and just celebrate their unique identities together.
Yeah.
In San Diego, I mean, you know, this is America's finest city, but every cultural group in this diverse city is represented except for the African-American community. And the African-American community is one of the strongest and most accomplished and, you know, achieved groups of people in San Diego. And we really do ourselves a disservice by not highlighting that and having a place where we get together to celebrate Black art and culture. To not see yourself celebrated, to not see yourself embraced by the city and the government, to, you know, to hear like the term Southeast. In San Diego for years, almost 20 years, if there was something negative that happened anywhere in San Diego, it would be reported. In Southeast San Diego today, there was a drive-by shooting, there was a this, there was a that. Negating all of our neighborhoods, Webster's, Emerald Hills, Encanto, where we have the Black Arts Culture District, Skyline, Paradise Valley, all of those neighborhoods and that whole sense of joy of family and coming together, like LaRaza said, who we really are and how we really operate, was covered under this term called Southeast. And then with Southeast, it was connected to gang banging and that whole gangster. When, you know, the gangster rap came and the whole serial killer music ended up coming to light. For us to have our own nine blocks and own the businesses in the nine blocks and to on purpose be there to celebrate the way we live, the way we talk, the way we dress, the way just everything about us, and also raising the level of appreciation for the rest of the world, for the rest of San Diego. To be able to go somewhere and see Black, like you can go to Chicano Park, or you can go to the Asian Culture District, or you can go to other places and see that culture celebrated, that didn't exist in San Diego, and now it does.
I was just going to add, I mean, it's just important to us to have that representation. You know, this is our community, and really passionate and unwavering in supporting the vision that we have to continue to go and just continue to dream bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of that, I mean, even though, you know, the community, like many Black communities, have sort of been, it's sort of been put underneath this light of suspicion for so long. And then now you've got this opportunity to really celebrate it, to have a place of your own, right, of our own, a cultural hub. I mean, talk about the resilience. What's one way the community has surprised you in the past, in this post-flood year, during these rebuilding efforts?
Well, from my standpoint, I would say that it was the assistance that we received to revitalize the space, from folks coming to help us remove furniture, replace furniture, donating file cabinets and things along those lines. You know, that was, in my eyes, truly the power of our community and the resilience of our community. Because just for me specifically, having that lower floor of our mixed use building be a place for us to gather and celebrate Black arts and cultures, for our timeline to be pushed back by the flood, and to get the assistance from the community, for me, it was really a truly amazing thing to see. And it was unexpected, but greatly appreciated.
Dahan, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, her and her family, and people like her and her family. One of the things that people constantly say is the ice is colder in other neighborhoods. You know, like, I'm like, ice is ice. And for her and other African-American families to come together and literally purchase property and establish, you know, a business. And, you know, the stereotype is we don't do that. You know, the mm-hmm. Chaldean community will come in. The Asian communities will come in. Everyone else will come into our communities and make money, but us. And for her and many other Black business owners and entrepreneurs to come to those nine blocks and not just talk about it, but literally put their money where their mouth is and purchase property, develop property with the idea in mind of uplifting and creating generational wealth. People said that didn't exist. People like, you know, say, oh, that's Southeast. It's this negative, you know, all this negative connotation. She and her family are a perfect example of what that area is about. The judges that live in that area, they can live anywhere they want to live in the world. They choose to live in Encanto. Judges, doctors, lawyers, people who are successful, you know, athletes, they still live there. And so for someone as young as her and her sister and her mom to come together, and then the other young entrepreneurs who have come and purchased property, we own over 75% of the property in the nine blocks now. And so now we can develop the park and know that we have businesses, that the park and these businesses are going to create something greater and bigger, like LaRaza was saying. Our history is Harlem of the West. When Harlem closed down in New York, it moved to San Diego, downtown San Diego. But so many times, like Black Wall Street, we have developed things in San Diego and it's been taken from us. And so this time, this group of community people have come together and said, never again. We're going to own it. We're going to direct it. We're going to name, define, create, and speak it into existence. And that's what we have the opportunity to spread the joy and not just focus on the negative, but to focus on the positive and continue to go forward.
Right. I just wanted to reiterate, I think the flood, you know, it taught us the importance of preparation and adaptability. That's why we've made significant upgrades to prepare and prevent damages in the future, like including better drainage systems in our building. But beyond those physical challenges, we've learned how essential it is to have the creative spaces where we can gather and heal and thrive together. So the Block Club for us, it's not just about recovering from the flood, but it's about reimagining, you know, what's possible when our community comes together.
Coming up, we continue the conversation about how the San Diego Black Arts and Culture District is rebuilding and looking to the future 1 year after devastating floods.
There could be something in San Diego where I like to say where the world could meet to celebrate Black art and culture.
KPBS Midday Edition is back after the break.
KPBS On Demand is supported by the San Diego International Jewish Film Festival, celebrating its 35th year starting January 27th. This year's festival features more than 30 films from 13 countries with special events and guest filmmakers. Tickets at sdijff.org.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. I'm with Dahan Blevins, the founder and CEO of the nonprofit arts organization San Diego Urban Warriors, and LaRaza Webb, co-founder of the Block Club. Dahan, you actually played an important role in getting this designation for the San Diego Black Arts and Culture District. Remind us what that designation is.
For us, the word is Kuji Chagulia. It's the second principle in Kwanzaa. And it means self-determination. For us to have the opportunity to name for ourselves, to define for ourselves, to create for ourselves and speak for ourselves, and to develop that pride for the generations who come after us. So I feel like it's kind of like in our DNA, it's in our blood. And we're not just going to accept somebody saying, okay, well, they don't have it, but it's Southeast, so it doesn't matter. Those are almost fighting words for us. It's take every single city council person from West Pratt all the way to Monica Montgomery had to deal with the wrath of community youth and parents and organizations saying, we want our own Black Arts and Culture District. And finally, when we got to Monica Montgomery, she did it.
Mm-hmm.
So now we got to build. And it's up to the entire city. It's not just the African-Americans' responsibility. It's the city is remiss. The county of San Diego is remiss. This should have been in existence way back when we had Cool Jazz and Jazz is Forever and Interfest. We've done it at, we designed the amphitheater at Market Creek Plaza. Once again, it was taken away from us.
Mm-hmm.
This is ours. We own it. It's designated to us. We have business owners and entrepreneurs like LaRaza and the Cunninghams and just nine blocks of young Black entrepreneurs. And so that's something that needs to be celebrated by everybody.
Mm-hmm. It's a process of reclaiming, what was already yours and the determination to do it, the self-determination to do it. And it sounds like it was a multi-generational and community-wide effort. I mean, LaRaza, it really sounds like that's the case. What does the designation mean to you?
It feels, for me, it's truly an honor to have the representation. Just would reiterate everything that Dahan has mentioned about the importance of having the Black art and culture being represented in San Diego. We have a very small percentage. We're a small percentage in San Diego County in general. And so I would say that also I grew up in Southeastern San Diego, participating in parades, from walking with the Elementary Institute of Science to practicing capoeira in parades and the Encanto Street Fair, you know. So to also have gone away for college, got my education, went to Clark Atlanta, and then come back, also fired up, just as Dawn was speaking about, to bring back that, have our footprint stamped, but in concrete, so that it can't be washed away, is very important to me. And it's important that for me to represent and stand on the shoulders of the people that have done the work up to this point, and also to grab that baton strong, firm, and with confidence that has been instilled and built in me, and to continue on until it's time for me to pass it on to the next generation. That's what I see, and that's my vision for these nine blocks, and that's why it's important to me.
Yeah. In addition to the flooding damages, what other challenges is the district currently facing, Dahan?
Racism, the lack of equity, the disproportionality that Black people and people of color suffer in this country and have suffered since we've been here, or since they've been here in our lives. We are in every aspect of government, every aspect of from the city to the county to the community boards, every hoop that, you know, has been said, you need to jump through these kind of hoops, you need to do this, you need to do that. We are entrenched in all of those things. But yet we find ourselves almost 40 years later still dealing with the same craziness. I mean, I remember back when, you know, they literally put the signs up for us to have a Martin Luther King Boulevard like every other major city in the United States. And I was there when they took them down. The signs were up like maybe a day and a half. And we were told that by, you know, business owners, people who were bold enough to come out in the streets and tell us, we don't want any, you know, the N-word names on any of our streets. Mm-hmm. That's a legacy in San Diego. That's something that not just the African-American community needs to address, but the entire city of San Diego needs to address the redlining, the whole creation of the term Southeast. Mm-hmm. All of those kinds of things, as wonderful as this city is, as resilient as we are, as beautiful as our beaches and our canyons and just everything about our city, when you go to Google and look up the Black community and look at how San Diego celebrates its African American or its Black community, it's really diverse here. So there's maybe over 54 different, you know, cultural groups just in the 4th District, but we have not done a good job celebrating all of ourselves. You would think we were just a white beach town, and we're remiss for that.
Right. And LaRaza, like, there's always this question of, you know, how can people support the San Diego Black mm-hmm. Arts and Culture District and the Black mm-hmm. community moving forward? And that's always the big question, but sometimes the other question, too, is how can people, like, just get out of the way so that the Black Arts and Culture District can be great and the Black community can be great?
Haven't heard it phrased that way, but yeah. I would say we were always looking for ways to, like, collaborate, you know, volunteers, other supporters, you know, whether folks want to host an event or teach a class or just come by. And, you know, specifically for the Block Club, those things are always, like, welcome for folks to get involved. And I think that the best way to stay out of the way but be helpful is to come into the Black Arts and Culture District to teach a class, come and host an event, you know, get familiar with the arts and culture and of the Black community here in San Diego, and really just identify how resilient we are, but have that respect for the way that we do things, which may come off, you know, less political, I suppose, you know, just really creative and be a testament to the amazing things that we're able to create together.
Mm-hmm. And when I say get out of the way, like, specifically, I'm talking about policies that really stand in the way of our community thriving.
No, I totally got what you're saying. And but I love the balance that we have because of the joy factor. You know what I'm saying? 20% of what we're going to focus on is going to continue to be the politics. We just can't, you know, it just goes along with, especially with the climate that we're going to be in now. That's going to be there. But our focus is really going to be the joy factor, because that's really what Black culture is. With all of the craziness that has happened to us, yeah, I mean, literally, people trying to take you out. But we still keep thriving and growing and developing and, you know, rebuilding Black Wall Street. It took almost 40 years for us to get this designation, and all the naysayers, there are people who literally passed away saying it'll never happen, it'll never happen. So they're ancestors now, and we owe it to them to make it bigger and better. And I mean, I'm political, urban warriors, we're political, you know, into the economics and the cultural thing, but to see the younger people like LaRaza and the other groups, the younger people that are coming in, and they're not tainted, they're not like, it's just throw your hands up, just give up, just move to Mars. None of them are like that. And it makes, you know, it kind of re-energizes, you know, the senior citizens of the crew to continue to go. And so I want to push the philanthropy. You know, there's a park. We don't just have 9 blocks. We have a whole park. And if people who have the wealth would come and invest that money into that park, the history of San Diego being cool jazz is forever. I mean, what was it? Jazz is forever. The cool jazz at the stadium used to be here. San Diego is just a city of music and jazz and theater and, you know, incredible weather. If the right philanthropists come along and invest in that park, there would be some place like world renowned, like how they have Leimert Park in L.A. We could have some place even more incredible than that, like we have in Oakland, you know, at the lake. There could be something in San Diego where I like to say where the world can meet to celebrate Black art and culture. And I'm talking about all of the culture of the entire diaspora right here in San Diego. That would bring, it would bring economics, it would bring growth, it would bring a whole new energy that would bless all of San Diego, not just the African-American community.
I've been speaking with Tahan Blevins, founder and CEO of the nonprofit arts organization San Diego Urban Warriors. Tahan, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for giving. Thank you for your support over, you know, this journey, first of all, and for giving the support that you're giving us right now since the flood is over and keeping us fresh. Thank you from the bottom of my heart, because this has really been an effort of love and a long, long journey.
Well, thank you for sharing your journey and your stories with us. Also, LaRaza Webb, co-founder of The Block Club, a new community space in the San Diego Black Arts and Culture District. LaRaza, thank you so much.
Thank you all for giving us this platform to share our journey. We're incredibly excited to invite everyone to the Block Club's grand opening in March, where we'll continue to celebrate creativity, resilience that we're speaking of, and the power of community. This space is for all of us, and I can't wait to see the amazing things that we'll create together. Thank you.
Up next, the weekend preview and a couple of film festivals you won't want to miss.
You know, cinema going, people often talk about this as, you know, nobody wants to do it anymore. Does anyone go to movie theaters? Well, we have each other's backs on this, and we let each other know, like, hey, this is a great new venue that's here in town, new ways of seeking audiences, and we are all stronger together.
The different ways film festivals are supporting one another when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
KPBS On Demand is supported by News from Native California, the illuminating source for Native stories in the Golden State. Each subscription to News from Native California directly supports Indigenous journalism. Learn more at newsfromnativecalifornia.com.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. Today's weekend preview will once again have a film focus because we have multiple film festivals on the horizon. Joining me once again is KPBS cinema junkie Beth Accomando. And new to weekend preview is Brian Hu, artistic director of the San Diego Asian Film Festival and also associate professor in television, film, and new media at San Diego State University. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian, since you're new to Weekend Preview, give us a little background on what you do with the San Diego Asian Film Festival.
Well, I have the very lucky job of being able to select the films. So this is going through hundreds of films. We just opened our call for entries for our November festival. So it's doing a lot of research about what's big in Asian cinema around the world, new trends, new filmmakers, and then trying to corral all the newest ones to bring here in San Diego so that our audiences get to see them first.
And San Diego has a vibrant film festival scene with both the San Diego International Jewish Film Festival and San Diego Black Film Festival coming up. Do these festivals support each other in any way?
We have email threads. We all know kind of what everyone is doing because we understand that, you know, cinema going, people often talk about this as, you know, nobody wants to do it anymore. Does anyone go to movie theaters? Well, we have each other's backs on this, and we let each other know, like, hey, this is a great new venue that's here in town, new ways of seeking audiences, and we are all stronger together. So yeah, so we're always abreast of what each other is doing.
Great. Well, and Beth, you have a film to recommend that will be showcased at both the Jewish and Black film festivals. What is it?
Yeah, it's not often that a film will play at two festivals kind of overlapping, but this is the case now. And these festivals are just beyond the weekend, so I'm cheating a tiny bit. But I do feel like for film festivals, people need a little time for prep work, maybe a little reconnaissance, going through the program, figuring out what they want to do, when they can get to the films. But yes, there is a wonderful documentary called Ain't No Back to a Merry-Go-Round, and this is a documentary about integrating Maryland's Glen Echo Amusement Park in 1960. So this is going to screen on February 5th at the Jewish Film Festival and January 31st in an afternoon screening at the San Diego Black Film Festival. And to give you a little sense of what the film's about, here is the trailer.
This park is segregated. You're not trespassing.
Let me ask you, race.
My race, I belong to the human race.
Oh, we were dying to get in there.
I really wanted to ride on the carousel. Why couldn't we go and have fun like everybody else?
We were some bold people.
I knew that was something better for me.
The Holocaust radicalized me.
The fight for civil rights is as much my fight as it is theirs.
That was the first time I had any social contact with a white person.
I was surprised because the majority of the people picketing were white.
Whose picket line is this?
So I had a chance to speak to the director, Ilana Trachman, and she had grown up with photos of the amusement park, which had become an art center and national park. And when she wanted to use it for her wedding, a park ranger explained the history of how it had been integrated. And she said she was dumbfounded that the park had been whites only because she had thought of it as this beloved recreation destination and never realized that the photos she'd grown up with were only showing whites enjoying the park. And so that was the impetus for her. She said it came from both shame and being intrigued by the idea that this was a lost civil rights history. So then she explained to me the process of finding archival material for the documentary.
Anything that was potentially saving Washington, D.C. area history over the summer of 1960 was a possible source. But of course, nobody knew it was history, so nobody filed it that way. Unlike, say, the March on Washington, which you can type into your computer and like listings will come up, nobody had ever filed any of this. There was like a handful of photographs that had been saved in that time. There was this stunning audio recording that's in the film that a radio reporter recorded of an interchange between an African-American protester and a white security guard who is literally saying to him, "You can't come in. Can I ask your race?" And he says, "Well, I'm a member of the human race." And he says, "Well, this park is segregated." He says, "Well, what class of persons do you allow to come in here?" And the security guard says, "White people." And, you know, it's so overt. One of the people that I spoke to in those early days, who had been, I don't know, I think around seven at the time, she called me a few years later because she had found a little yellow Kodachrome box that was labeled Glen Echo 1960. She asked me if I wanted it. And when I saw the first frame and I understood that I was looking at the protest, I mean, I fell on the floor. And then I got up and quickly like turned off the projector because I didn't want it to burn the footage. And then I found a few other pieces after that as well.
So the archival material in this film is great, and it's a wonderful film that looks to this moment in time. So the Jewish and the Black film festivals do overlap, so you can choose where to watch the film. The 35th annual San Diego International Jewish Film Festival runs from January 27th to February 8th at the JCC, and they have over 30 feature films that they'll be screening. And the San Diego Black Film Festival is going to be running January 29th to February 2nd at the AMC La Jolla 12. So those are your options for that.
Very interesting. Beth, you've also brought in another artist to share a weekend recommendation. Who is it today?
Yes. So this is Eric Leonardis, who I met when he was introducing films for the Nat on a real science film program. And he's not only a scientist, but he's also a DJ. And here's what he'd like to recommend.
Hello, this is Dr. Eric Leonardis, neuroscientist and DJ here in San Diego. I'm here to invite you this week to House Music Fridays at the Air Condition Lounge in North Park. Special guest will be Josh Jackson, aka Jameis. He's one of my favorite producers right now. He's had major releases with Vessel Recordings and Quantize Recordings. You're not gonna wanna miss his deep Jack and House tunes. Also with support from the resident people's champ, DJ Matthew Bryan. This Friday, January 24th, from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m., 4673 30th Street. You don't wanna miss it. See you on the dance floor.
And that music you hear underneath, Eric, is from DJ Matthew Bryan.
That sounds fun, but Brian, you may not be getting out as much these days because in addition to being the artistic director of a film festival, you have recently become a parent, and that changes your life considerably. Congratulations to you, by the way.
Thank you.
So do you have something to recommend that parents can find any weekend as an activity for kids?
Yeah, I've recently discovered that Barnes and Nobles are amazing places to take kids. I mean, I grew up being able to go to Toys R Us and FAO Schwarz and like the idea of toy stores. You can just go and look at colorful objects for a little bit and look at your parents and see if they'll buy it for you. I feel like Barnes & Nobles have become that. I was just at a Barnes & Noble yesterday looking up some A24 swag because apparently Barnes & Noble has a lot of A24 exclusives now. And then my kid just stops and looks at aisles and aisles of toys. So obviously there's the toy section, but there's some Barnes & Nobles that are really decked out for kids. The La Mesa one has this great like area where you can just sit and read to your kids and just flip through pages. They tend to be very clean and air-conditioned and with parking. Yeah, kind of a hidden gem, the Barnes & Nobles all around town. And, of course, a way to support bookstores. I'm always in favor of that.
Right. Well, now, if parents want to introduce their kids to books without the temptation of actually buying them, you've got a favorite library, and that's the Central Library downtown. What do you like about it?
Yeah, well, first of all, parking. it's pretty easy to get to. I find that it's not usually packed in the kids section, but they have a lot there. There are areas where you can just sit and read, obviously, but there's computers that you can just fiddle around at. My kid is always saying parents are always working. All she wants to do is work at a computer because that's what she sees us doing. And at the library, she has many to choose from. She can, like, read books on the computers. And they have, like, all these, like, toys that she wishes she had at home. And also, like, this is also where she could run into other kids. On weekends, we find that she's the only child and it's just her and us. And she can go out and, like, see other people her age and I can meet other parents as well. Yeah, libraries are a great place for all this.
Great recommendations there. Beth, you have another film to recommend at the San Diego International Jewish Film Festival, another documentary, but this one about an artist, right?
Yes. So the Jewish Film Festival has a lot of films coming up, and this one is called The True Story of Tamara D. Lampicka and the Art of Survival. And this will screen on February 6th, and here is the trailer.
Tamara D. Lampicka.
Tamara D. Lampicka.
First of the Lampickas. $5 million. Amy's bidder now. $5 million.
The woman, the machine, the woman looking to the future in charge of her life. Tamara decided to become a painter to support herself, her family, her child, and survive. And she did, and she became one of the most sought-after portrait painters in Paris and in Italy and eventually the world. There's a new generation that's discovering her and falling in love with her. Tamara was a survivor.
She invented her own style. And so, as she said, in a whole room full of paintings, you can immediately recognize mine.
So San Diegans may remember that there was a musical about her life that had its West Coast premiere here at the La Jolla Playhouse.
I want to feel your soft lips, your sharp teeth, feel your nails in my flesh, your light, your color, your pulse, your sweat, your speed, your muscle, your flesh, your skin, your bone.
So we just heard some music from the La Jolla Playhouse production, Lampicka. And while Tamara D. Lampicka's name may not be familiar to everyone, I feel like a lot of people have probably been exposed to her work in some way. Maybe it was just in the background of a Madonna video. But her style was very bold, vivid, unique. And the documentary tries to explore both her visual style and artistry, along with the complexities and challenges she had in her life. I got to speak with the director, Julie Rubio, and she explained the challenges she had trying to capture Tamara D. Lampicka's life for this documentary.
She was living in a world that wanted her gone because she was Jewish, because she was a woman. She was other, and she was celebrating that she was other. And I just think her art captures beauty, but it also captures that horrific war times and her remarkable will to survive and reinvent herself, you know? Tamara's life is a powerful statement to the devastating impact of war and the human capacity for resilience. You know, she just kept reinventing. And the film at its core has turned out to be an anti-war movie because history is repeating itself again. And you're watching these things going, wait a minute, but we already learned this. And it's like, no, maybe we haven't. So I think it underscores the urgency and the need to learn from that history and find new peaceful ways to resolve our differences, because her life is a roadmap. It's showing us, you know, what happens when we fail to confront horrors and conflict, and at the same time inspiring that light, inspiring us and showing us just her will to survive through displacement, through pain, through anti-Semitism, through ageism. And then that journey calls us to, you know, choose, I think, empathy and understanding and innovation over violence, which is just so easy. It's just like this knee-jerk reaction that we have now. It makes me feel that there's this need beyond tolerance for one another, but just acceptance and love. And we just need that right now so much.
That is very beautiful and sounds like one of those films that really is mind-opening. Brian, you are between festivals right now, but with current events in the Middle East and here in the U.S. with a new administration, what do you see as the importance of film festivals? I mean, how can they provide context to current events or just keep us aware of other perspectives?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what makes film festivals so valuable is that they're not just headlines. I think so much of how we're digesting the news right now are from headlines and short pieces that are designed to give you stress. Film festivals aren't here to stress you out. They're here to give you context. They're here to deepen your understanding of the world. And also they're, to some extent, here to give you a little bit of escape from that tension, too. I think some of my film festivals have a reputation for, you know, giving us our vegetables, our cinematic vegetables. But these are where we get some of the most, you know, brazen experiments in entertainment that you'll find anywhere in the world. And I think we need that, too. I mean, I personally don't read a lot of magazine articles as much as I used to. And I found that, you know, like film festivals, these films we're watching, spending an hour and a half with, are giving me some of that deepened human connection that I used to get from reading like a 5,000-word piece. And once you're in that space, you're away from that kind of tribalism that a lot of our headlines are kind of adhere to, and you can just really be humans with these subjects. This is where I think film festivals are play such a huge part in our culture.
That's so very true, Brian. And Beth, you've got one final weekend recommendation from a local artist?
Yes, I do. Actually, she's someone who has a connection to the Asian Film Festival. Amy Fan is a photographer and a filmmaker, and she is also an avid film festival goer. But I asked her if she could recommend something that might counteract the kind of passive viewing you do at a film festival and maybe offer an opportunity to get off your butt.
Hi, my name is Amy Fan. I am a videographer and filmmaker. One thing I love doing for fun is roller skate. My favorite place to skate is at Ringer's Roller Rink, where they have public skates and live DJs every week. Ringer's also has a bank track for roller derby, and I am also a roller derby referee. I love roller skating and roller derby because, first of all, it's super fun. And secondly, it's really good for your physical and mental health. And most importantly, the people I've met in these communities have been amazing. If you are at all interested in learning about bank track roller derby, there's an upcoming orientation you're welcome to attend on Saturday, February 1st at 10:30 a.m.
Well, that sounds fun. Any last-minute recommendations, Beth?
Yes, I will do a shameless self-promotion plug. The Film Geeks San Diego group that I'm a volunteer programmer with, we are kicking off our year-long film series of neo-noir and international horror with the British gangster classic called Get Carter, starring Michael Caine as one of the coldest-blooded gangsters you will ever find. But it's a fabulous film.
Jack Carter, what are you doing around here, then?
I'm visiting relatives.
You're a big man between bad shape. Me, it's a full-time job.
And if you're more in the mood for something Italian and stylish, there is a marathon of Italian giallo films by Popcorn Reef that'll be down at 10th Avenue Theater.
And Brian, anything you want to add?
I'm always down to take my family to the San Diego New Children's Museum, which is such a gem here in town. They have, of course, art that you could play in. But also, like, I don't want to have a huge mess in our house, so I'd rather use somebody else's clay that she can put her hands on. So yeah, just places like that, that where we can like feel close to the world, but also playing. I'm always in search of places like that. And then of course, Lunar New Year is right around the corner. Lunar New Year is not just a day or two for Vietnamese, Chinese people here in town. It's like a 3-week affair. A lot of meals to be had, a lot of lion dancing. The big one, I think, is next week. There's going to be a big Tet Festival at Liberty Station. But this weekend, there's going to be one in City Heights at the Jeremy Henwood Memorial Park, where there's going to be contests and food and dancing. So check that out.
Well, thank you both for sharing your weekend plans. And thanks to the artists who shared their recommendations. I've been speaking with KPBS cinema junkie Beth Accomando and Brian Hu, artistic director of the San Diego Asian Film Festival and associate professor in television, film, and new media at San Diego State. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
KPBS On Demand is supported by the San Diego International Jewish Film Festival, celebrating its 35th year starting January 27th. This year's festival features more than 30 films from 13 countries with special events and guest filmmakers. Tickets at sdijff.org.